Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. During the Cold War of the 50s and 60s, and even a little afterwards, nuclear war was always in the back of everyone's mind, kind of like terrorism is today. But the feeling of a cloud hanging over everyone's lives was bigger then, because a nuclear war would end life as we knew it. The weapons by then were so powerful that they'd make the Hiroshima bomb look like a toy. With thousands of nuclear warheads mounted on intercontinental ballistic missiles and submarines, both we and the Russians, then called the Soviets, were restrained mainly by the threat of mutually assured destruction, which was appropriately called MAD. There would be no winner of that war. So many of those nuclear missiles were hidden in plain sight in underground silos, scattered around lightly populated areas of the country in places like the Dakotas and Montana and Kansas. And there were some in Arkansas, one actually about an hour outside Little Rock near the town of Damascus, Arkansas. Now, the Air Force naturally kept as tight a lid of secrecy on these things as they could, and for all the people nearby knew, nothing ever happened there. But sometimes things did happen, and in a few cases, the things that happened brought us to the brink of unimaginable catastrophe. This week, we're going to tell the story of one of those events, which took place in 1980. It'll be aired on PBS's American Experience on Tuesday, January 10th, in a program called Command and Control. It's based on a 2013 book by Eric Schlosser titled Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety. So we're getting a preview of that show here today. My guest is Greg Devlin, who's a former missile technician who was there and lived to tell about it. Welcome, Greg.
Thanks, Court, for inviting me to your show.
Greg's joining us from Titusville, Florida, which is right across the Indian River Lagoon from Cape Kennedy. Former Air Force guy, and that's why he's there. There's an Air Force base there, too. So, Greg, tell us first about the missile you were assigned to then and what its payload was.
Well, I worked for the, just so you know, I worked for the 308 Strategic Missile Wing at Little Rock Air Force Base. But the night of the event was a Titan II missile, and it was in Damascus, Arkansas. A monstrous weapon, to be honest with you.
So what was your job?
I was a fuel systems specialist with the Titan IIs. So we handled the hydrazine, they called it UDMH, and nitrogen tetroxide. So we would actually fuel them and then pressurize them, which would put them on alert. And then if the pressure ever got too low, the commanders would call us back, and then we'd have to find out what the problem was. Was there a leak? So sometimes we replaced the seals inside of them and then had to replace the fuel. But one way or the other, we were always working with very hazardous commodities.
How long had you been there?
At the time, I'd been there 3 years and 4 months on my first four-year assignment.
What was the facility like? I mean, I described it as being a hole in the ground, and I guess it had a cap over it. But kind of walk us through just briefly what it was like outside and inside.
You would drive up to a single entry point road, you know, off the main highway. It'd be maybe a quarter of a mile back, and then you would wind up at this complex. And really, from the outside, it just looked like a huge fence that, say, a rectangular fence around this, had a massive 743-ton silo door sitting in the center of it. And it had just some antennas on the top, and it had signal lights to warn you if there was a hazard. So, and a box on the outside of the fence. And when you first got there, you had to let the commanders know who you were, and then they would open the fence electronically. You could slide the fence back, and then you had to go into what they called the portal, so you could do a code control. And one guy on the team would have the only secret code to go inside that portal, and then give the commander those exact numbers. He had one attempt. If you missed it on the first attempt with one letter or one number that was wrong, and you missed it, they would immediately lock the place down and bring a security would come out and check you guys out to make sure you were legit.
Wow. I guess you focused on that little task every time you did it.
Every time, right.
Yeah. So from the outside, it was obviously a government or military facility, but basically it was a concrete cap covering something. And so what was the something inside? What was it? What was it like inside?
When you first go down through the portal and where they would bring you in through security, would let you in, you would go three stories down and you would enter a 6,000-pound blast lock door. So electronically, you would open this door, slide, move it out of the way, and then your team would move into what they call the blast lock area. So two of these 6,000-pound blast lock doors, and then you would close them behind you. one at a time. So then once you entered, you could either make a left-hand turn, which would be another 6,000-pound door, to enter the launch control center, which was like a, just picture a great big egg turned upside down. So a great big egg, and it had three levels inside the egg. And when you walked into the middle level. That was actually the place that they launched the missile. If they ever had to launch the missile, it would be from that area. If you would have made a right turn to the blast lock, there's another 6,000-pound blast lock door on your right, you would go down about a 120-foot tunnel, would take you out to the silo or the massive hole in the ground. And from there were eight different levels. So each level, you could enter the missile at different levels, depending on whether you're working on stage one or stage two, or the engines at the bottom. And then at the very bottom is right underneath the missile is what they call the W. What it did was, as the flames were launching, it would split those flames and then run them back up outside the ramp, outside to the above ground, so that the rocket could launch without exploding in the silo from all the flames.
So this was a Titan II missile. How tall was it total?
103-foot tall missile.
So it's pretty deep hole in the ground, like a big tube with this rocket inside of it.
It was awesome. Every time you walked in that place, it was just kind of overwhelming to look at the power of that and the size of that monster missile.
I can imagine. I mean, you know, picture a large missile sitting on the pad at Cape Kennedy that we mentioned, and instead that's underground, and you're right up next to it coming out, as you described, onto some little balcony and looking at a part of it feet away from you. All right, so like just briefly, Greg, what was it like to work there on a day-to-day basis? Was it, you know, just pretty routine? I mean, nothing was happening. We weren't launching a missile every day, so was it just kind of ho-hum?
Oh, no. Our days were 14 to 16-hour days on a regular basis. And one of the reasons is because the Titan IIs with the liquid fuels were constantly leaking. And if they leak, then they don't have enough pressure in the tank, so it takes them off of alert. So what that would do is that put us in a position where we had to go to that missile. And if you have multiple missiles that are leaking, they have the option of either pressurizing them, which is fine. But if it continues to leak fuel, then you have to do a full operation where you remove all the fuels off of that stage, pull them up into tankers up above ground, and then put new seals in, and then replace the fuels on board and repressurize them. So that might be a one-week process. So if you have multiple missiles leaking fuel, we were either working on trying to keep them pressurized or working on our equipment, because maintaining the equipment was a lot of work, and we rarely had time to become bored, I'd say.
Gosh, I didn't realize all that was going on, that there was leakage on a routine basis like that. So that was pretty tricky, because one false move and you could be in real trouble. And that's really what the topic of our show is. You are listening to American Variety Radio, and I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Greg Devlin, who is an Air Force technical specialist, a missile technician assigned to a nuclear missile silo in Damascus, Arkansas, in 1980, where something really big happened that nobody really heard about for a while. Tell us, Greg, what happened that day.
Well, what happened was first shift team had been on duty for, probably eight hours or so on other sites. And then they got a call, said, you guys got one more, go out to complex 4-7 and pressurize the tank out there. So it's a simple operation in a sense, but it still requires the propellant transfer systems, what they call them PTS guys, to go out there, put their REFCO suit, which is a rocket fuel handler clothing outfit. So they would put those suits on. But anyway, what happened was the guy had the socket, which is an 8-pound socket, on a 3-foot ratchet. Picture this big setup. And then you have to take the gas cap. You got to take the cap off of the rocket so you can hook the fuel line to it and pressurize it through that fuel line. And he never could get it all the way on the ratchet, so it separated as he broke the cap loose and he started to release pressure. The socket fell off the ratchet. It bounced on the platform that he was standing on, and in a split second, it was gone. It had bounced right towards the missile, and where the platform comes up against the missile is a rubber boot. The socket was so heavy, it pushed its way past there, dropped 70 foot, and then hit what they call the thrust mount, which holds the missile upright, and bounced inward. It punctured the bottom fuel tank with, say, 14,000 gallons of hydrazine on board.
So when the socket punched a hole in the fuel tank, what started to happen?
Well, fuel, as soon as it comes out, it starts to, it looks like just a white, milky, smoky stuff, and it's spraying out. And it's very, very hazardous in that manner. So because it's pouring fuel out and it's at the very bottom, remember, these guys are standing up on, say, level two there, and they're looking down and going, oh my gosh, this tank is pouring fuel out. Now what do we do? Because there's no checklist, there's no technical orders that have been written for this scenario where it's pouring fuel out of the bottom of the tank. And it's very hazardous. At that level of fuel, it would literally melt the suits that they wear to keep them protected. So it's a very, it would be a very high concentration of fuel and very, very dangerous.
Yes, yeah, so hydrazine is a very toxic fuel. It's not like you'd want to breathe or touch it, and here it's pouring out, and there's no handy-dandy cork you can stick in the hole, and so it's just pouring out. So from that point on, what started to happen? I mean, obviously, the risk then is an explosion of all this highly flammable stuff spewing out of this giant rocket into a tiny control, you know, a contained space, the silo. So what did they do?
Well, the guys first were stunned and went, oh my gosh. So they radioed they were coming back. And what happened was, to the commander, they're seeing all these lights in, on their panels lighting up like there's a fire with fuel. And then they see it looks like a fire with oxidizer. And so they're getting, all the lights are lighting up on the panel. Oh, we got a problem here. But, you know, what is the problem? So the guys come back down the silo. They go through those two 6,000-pound blast lock doors and get back into the control center, and basically told them, we dropped a socket. The socket fell off the ratchet, and it punctured the bottom fuel tank. Now we have this really hazardous, horrible situation that's continuing to get worse as the fuel pours out into the bottom of the W. It literally could have exploded just from pouring out. If it touches grease, if it, there are so many things that could set that off. And so it's just dumping fuel. And so then they had to call back to the, you know, base commander, their SAC commander, and then it went up the line, went up the chain of command as to how do we fix this problem.
So it's not even a case of one spark would set it off, but many different things would set it off. And so it began to, I would suspect, to look almost inevitable. This was going to blow up. So what did they do? Did they begin to evacuate? Or?
So from that point on, then it's out of the hands of the PTS technicians. It goes to the commander at the silo there, and then he's radioing up the line. What do we do? So then it gets all the way to SAC Air Force, SAC Command in Nebraska, and they're trying to find out how do we fix this problem? So that went on for hours. They eventually evacuated the crew. They eventually evacuated everyone out of the complex and pulled them back about a quarter of a mile back at the entry point road. And then everybody else, they were running people out of, away from their homes. It got really bad, and they were trying to work through their checklist and their things up the line to figure it out.
You mentioned SAC, which is the Strategic Air Command. I think that's right.
Yes.
Did you guys have any sense that even they knew what to do, or were they just kind of flailing around?
The sense from the PTS technicians and the guys that were working there is that SAC A did not know what to do, and that they were delaying and delaying and delaying.
Oh, my gosh.
And we were willing to do our job. Let's either do something or let's leave. Let's do one of the two.
Right.
But just to sit here is, seem crazy.
Potential suicide. So, I mean, apart from the huge amount of fuel in this thing that's spewing out, exploding, and then blowing up the rest of the fuel that's left in the tank, apart from that more conventional explosion, which would be bad enough, was there also a possibility of that explosion detonating the massive nuclear warhead sitting on top of the rocket?
Well, I know that's a thought probably from everyone in the world, even from the people that work with the fuels and work with the Titans and work with nuclear weapons. We've always been told it was, you know, the odds were 1 billion to 1 of an accidental nuclear reaction. Like you couldn't accidentally make it happen. So, yes, I think there's a possibility of that. It is probably very minuscule, but still it's very scary because of the power of the warhead that's sitting on top.
Yeah, because from the little I know about it, I think that nuclear weapons are detonated by a conventional, let's say, dynamite explosion compressing inward from all sides and compressing the fissile material until it begins to react and do its thing. So I'm sure there were safeguards built into it to reduce that risk down to close to zero, one would hope, right?
Mm-hmm. So
how many megatons was this bomb?
9 megaton.
Oh, my gosh. So if that 9-megaton bomb that you were sitting there with were to have gone off, theoretically, hypothetically, mm-hmm. how widespread would the zone of total destruction be? And that's not even counting the fallout from it, right? But just the actual blast, would it be, you know, how many miles mm-hmm. across? Do you have any idea?
Well, I'm not an expert in that area. You know, I've heard 50 to 75 miles of just annihilation, and the fallout, radioactive fallout, would just, it could kill up to 10 million people,
yeah,
is what I've heard.
Depending on which way the wind was blowing, right, and what cities it went over and all
yes.
that. It would have been a massive catastrophe. I mean, the biggest one in our history, no doubt, you know, if that had gone off.
Yes.
So, but even so, you were there with, you know, huge amounts of this highly flammable fuel spilling out. So right away, the immediate zone of destruction potentially and highly likely would be great. So at what point were you brought in and to do what?
Because we were the fuel systems technicians, we were the second shift crew. And so the first shift crew had been on duty at about 11 and a half hours at the time the accident happened, where the socket was dropped. So we were brought out as backup. Okay, are they going to send us back in to reconnect to the missile? What are the possibilities here? Are we going to connect up? And, you know, I've heard all kinds of scenarios where they might have been able to stabilize the missile from lowering all the platforms that would hold the missile so it wouldn't buckle and fall on, you know, collapse on itself, to connecting up and venting tanks, or even doing what they call an offload, which is pulling all the fuels off of it and putting them in tankers on the top of the silo. So those were all possibilities for us because we were the fuel systems people. And that's why we were there. We were there. How can we help? What do you need us to do?
Once you were on the scene there and then knew fully what the situation was, what did you personally mm-hmm. think, Greg, that the chances of a blow were at that point?
I think we all thought it was a very real possibility. It was scary. I say this, and this is just a personal thought, is I had never, ever seen a Titan II explode, ever. I've never heard of it. So even though the situation is horrible in there and it can happen, there's a little side of you that's hoping it's never happened before, so maybe it won't happen here.
Well, and you guys are all young, and young men in particular tend to think they're invulnerable and the bad stuff isn't going to happen to them, so until
yes.
it does, right? But
exactly.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Greg Devlin about a scary event that he was very much at the center of in 1980 in Damascus, Arkansas, when he was a fuel technician on a Titan II missile down in a silo that had a hole punctured in its fuel tank and was spewing out huge amounts of highly toxic and flammable fuel. And he was called in as a fuel technician to try to deal with this runaway horse, right? So a question too, Greg, is that were local officials informed? I mean, people anywhere nearby were at risk from this. And in fact, as you just said, people up to 70 miles away were at great risk potentially. But were, you know, like the sheriff and so on, were they informed so that townspeople could be warned?
I think very little from what I hear afterward, very little. When the Air Force has a problem with a nuclear missile, they really keep it in-house. They really handle it themselves. They don't warn me. I don't think they tell everybody. They don't. You know, hey, everybody run. I don't think they do that. I think they keep it contained, keep it in-house, try to figure the problem out, try to fix the problem. And no, I don't think they knew a lot.
After the fact.
They found out probably by chance. Mm. And then because they find out, then the media finds out and that people start to spread the word. But yeah, I don't think they officially heard anything from the Air Force.
Yeah, I think that tends to be the practice of military services and NASA and Department of Energy mm-hmm. with nuclear facilities and so on. When there's an accident, you don't want to panic the population, so you keep a lid on it. And there's a PR aspect to it. All right,
right.
So here's we got a situation where the air is now being filled with fuel mist, even outside the silo, I think. And there were two guys. I admit I've seen a preview of the American Experience show, and two guys went in against orders to try to deal with it. What happened with them, and then what happened from there? How did it blow?
What it was is Jeff Kennedy was, by the way, is a good guy, a good friend of mine. He was kind of the lead team chief there. And he went under the guise of, I'm going to check the propane tank on the back side of the silo complex. So he went back in that direction. But Jeff's thought was, because no one was inside the control center and no one knew the tank pressures inside there. And Jeff knew they had all evacuated from their evacuation tunnel, Jeff Kennedy and another guy named Dave Powell went around the back, and they got to the escape hatch. Jeff started down the tube, and when Dave Powell was going to follow him, Jeff stopped him. He said, I'll get this because I can get in and get out faster. So Jeff went down the tube, entered the inside of the control center there, and what he really was doing was getting the pressures off of the gauges, because no one was inside there. Jeff thought he was actually helping. He was getting the pressures. He comes back up the tunnel. Him and Dave Powell come back out the gate. And then they told their commander there that, hey, here's what the tank pressures are right now. This is really bad. And they were like, how'd you get the tank pressures? You know, where'd those come from? So Jeff just told him, I went down to get him. So they were really upset about that. And then it wasn't very long from then. They actually sent myself and Rex Huckel in Refco suits. We had to cut through the fence. We broke through the portal door, and then they were going to send us down through the 6,000-pound blast lock doors, because inside the blast lock was what they called a vapor detector panel. They wanted us to get the reading off that panel. So we made it to the first door. We started to run out of air. They said, come back. Then they sent Jeff Kennedy and Dave Livingston in. They went in through the 2 6,000-pound blast lock doors, got the readings off the panel, which, by the way, it was pegged out. All the fuels and the mist and vapors in that inside the silo were so great, it was an explosion level. Mm-hmm. So they radioed back. They said, come on back. And as soon as Jeff Kennedy and Dave Livingston got topside, within seconds, the explosion happened. You know, then it blew. Jeff Kennedy was blown about 75 feet away, up against the fence with a broken leg. And Dave Livingston was a 150-pound guy and blew him over top of the fence. They found him on the outside of the fence. And so I was the backup crew, and I was standing right at the fence. And when it exploded, I slid 60 feet on my back with concrete, flames, and steel, glowing steel going past me. You know, amazingly, everyone survived there that night. And Dave Livingston passed away 12 hours later from his injuries on the site that night.
I can imagine what a blast that would be like. So you slid 60 feet down a road. Were you able to get up and run from there, or what did you do?
Well, the first thing I remember that hit me was a concussion of air. As soon as the door, the 743-ton door, starts to rise off those massive hydraulic pins that keep it locked in, first thing that came out was wind. It was like a concussion, like a Mack truck. It just blew me on my back, and I'm sliding up the road, and I honestly thought it was over. Yeah. I said, you know, I just hope it's not painful.
Sure.
But once I came to a stop, you know, I heard some screams to run, and I got up and took off running. I got 5 steps away, and a chunk of concrete as big as a school bus hit the ground right behind me.
Ooh.
And it had 20 to 30 foot long, one inch rebar hanging out of it. And this one of the strands, as I was running, whipped past and hit me in the left ankle, shattered my ankle, severed my Achilles tendon, and then I went down. So initially, I was on the ground, and I'm covering up, and I'm hearing massive chunks of concrete hit the ground, and finally all settled. And a colonel actually came by. Colonel Morris came running by, and he saw me, and he grabbed me and started to try to run with me and take me out of there. But Colonel Morris' fear was, he put me down, and he said, Devlin, if I don't get to the end of the road, they will leave us. So he runs to the end of the road, and everyone left. The ambulance drivers, as soon as the explosion happened, they flipped their lights on and drove off. All the news media jumped in their trucks and drove off. They all feared it was a nuclear reaction happening.
Yeah.
And so everyone left. The only guys that stayed were the PTS guys that were the fuel systems guys. But the PTS guys came back to get us. They said, we're not leaving without them. You know, we're not leaving without our friends. So, you know, I'm really glad for that.
So just briefly, what happened to the warhead? I think it just basically popped out of there like a cork out of an old-fashioned pop gun when the lid blew off and all the explosion pushed it out behind it.
Remember the entry road that takes you to the fence and to the complex? I was laying on the asphalt road until I heard the screams to run. I got 5 steps away. The chunk of concrete hit the ground. So I'm on the left side of the concrete, And if you look just to the right side of the concrete, in the ditch, right there, about, say, 30 or 40 feet away from me, is where they found what was left of the warhead. The main core of the warhead is like a great big bowling ball that's bolted to a small round garbage can. All the explosives inside of it were all fractured, meaning they could have went off. They just the explosions in that would have killed us that were around it. But that part, that didn't even happen.
Luckily, it didn't go off. Oof. So
exactly. Yeah.
Well, we're running out of time here, Greg, but I mean, just briefly, what happened afterward to the people involved? I mean, I saw in the preview that I saw that you were kind of treated badly. I mean, the guy who dropped the socket, yeah, I can understand some punishment there, but others who were trying their best to do their job to assess the thing weren't treated that well. What happened to you, briefly?
Well, the real issue was the Air Force did not want anyone talking at all. You know, that's hard not to do after an event like that. And so because of it, the guy dropped the socket. They served him with an Article 15. They gave Jeff Kennedy a letter of reprimand for going down into the silo without a second person. It's a two-man policy, kind of against orders. Myself, they just kept me in an area where they were putting the guys and girls out of the service for DUI or drugs or whatever, and they had me doing the same job they were doing. So I kind of felt like they mistreated me. You know, like, man, I'm doing the same job those guys are doing. And they said, well, you're going to be there until you get out. So they just treated us so bad. And this is just an opinion. If we would have been killed, no one can talk. And in a sense, that's better for Air Force and for the security and for the policies and all that.
Keep a lid on you. Nuclear weapons accidents are called, I think, broken arrows. What did you learn since all of this about the number and frequency of broken arrows in these missiles in the Air Force?
I believe there were like 32 broken arrows. I never knew anything about those. It was amazing there were that many accidents that happened in this field.
But I think this may have been the biggest one, partly because it was so visible and it exploded, but there were probably others that came real close to it, that kind of thing.
Yes.
And we still have tens of thousands of these things, nuclear weapons, that is. I know you're not an expert on this, but just generally from what you know, has the risk of accidents been reduced, and how are they safer now than they were? Just briefly.
If they've been reduced, it's solely because the number of them have been reduced. So I don't know if we've gotten better or worse with nuclear weapons, but they still exist, and it's an issue we're going to have to deal with really until they're either all gone or... Or the world's a different place.
Let's hope we have more good luck than we deserve on that, right? The title of the American Experience show is Command and Control. Command and Control. Obviously, it's an ironic title. How would you compare the risk of blowing ourselves up to the risk of someone else doing it?
Based on history and based on the incidents that have happened, that the number is very, very minuscule of it accidentally happening. So I pray it never does.
We've been talking with Greg Devlin about a nuclear accident that almost happened in Damascus, Arkansas in 1980. You can look it up on Wikipedia. Just type in Damascus Titan II and you'll get it. Greg, I want to thank you so much for being on with us on American Variety.
Thanks, Court. I really appreciate you inviting me to the show.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.